Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
You know, when you do it and this is the way you choose to express yourself, it's kind of a high wire act, sometimes with a net and sometimes without.
Chef David Talent spent 12 years in the restaurant business. Then he decided it was time to find a more sustainable work-life balance. We touch base to see what his culinary life is like these days. Bigger cows are producing more milk, but what are the trade-offs for farmers? Then we visit Jamie Scholl and Russ Finch to see how they're beating the cold and snow and growing food in the Midwest in the winter. And chocolate, lots of chocolate for Valentine's Day. Find out about farm and food news, we turn to Mark Chilla.
A story following up on Indiana's bird flu outbreak. Some 400,000 chickens and turkeys on 10 commercial farms in Indiana were killed last month to contain an outbreak of avian influenza. Some of the birds were killed using a method known as ventilation shutdown, which raises the air temperature to at least 104 degrees and causes death from heat stroke and suffocation. Animal rights groups condemn the technique, which can prolong suffering hours longer than other techniques. The USDA approved the method for the first time last fall, calling it a last resort when no other methods are available to kill birds within the 24-hour period. The preferred methods involve using carbon dioxide gas or covering the birds with suffocating foam, which kills the birds in a few minutes. But USDA officials say the water-based foam could not be used in Indiana's cold temperatures. Gassing is often impractical on chicken farms where birds are stacked vertically in cages. President Obama's budget proposal released this week sets new priorities for spending on programs for farmers and ranchers. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says proposed cuts to the crop insurance system in the 2017 budget are in response to criticism the department faced about possible wasteful spending and fraud.
So, in part, what is being proposed is a response to the various structures and organizations that Congress has set up and that Congress looks to for improvement in programs.
Obama's budget also includes increased spending on scientific research and updates on how states manage livestock disease outbreaks. The proposed budget will face an uphill battle in Congress, where some legislative leaders have already declared portions of it dead on arrival. U.S. beekeepers report losing about a third of their colonies each year. As Harvest Public Media's Amy Mayer reports, the persistent decline of honeybees has scientists scrambling for solutions.
New findings show that people have inadvertently caused bee diseases to spread quickly around the world. We move hives from place to pollinate crops, and that exposes bees to new threats. Iowa State University researcher Adam Dolezal says as semi-domesticated animals, bees are particularly susceptible.
They're like environmental sponges. They are covering this huge radius. They're collecting lots of different things. They're bringing them back to a central location. So they have a really large possibility of coming in contact with pathogens, coming in contact with pesticides or other chemicals.
Dolezal says beekeepers do have some tools to control diseases in their hives, and breeding research will continue in hopes of developing more resilient bees. Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And last week, the USDA announced it will crack down on the amount of salmonella it will allow on certain poultry products. Companies will be required to keep incidences of salmonella to under 15% of the chicken parts they produce, under new standards released Thursday. The USDA has had success in cutting the proportion of whole chickens found with salmonella. Now it's focusing on cut-up chicken parts and on ground chicken and turkey. As more and more consumers move away from buying whole chickens, concentrating food safety efforts on cut-up parts and ground poultry is especially important. Ground and processed poultry are also more likely to carry salmonella risk. The regulations, however, don't target the especially troublesome strains of salmonella responsible for some of the worst illness outbreaks, according to NPR's Dan Charles. Some have called for a plan that seeks to reduce specific strains of bacteria, such as Salmonella Heidelberg. The USDA hopes the new directive will eventually stop 50,000 people annually from getting sick. What news pinged your radar this week? Share stories and comments with us at Earth Eats on Twitter.
and our website, where these articles are posted, eartheats.org. Thank you, Mark.
Anytime.
America's dairy farms are doing more with less, quite literally. We have fewer dairy cows today than just a few decades ago, but they're churning out more milk than ever. Dairy cows have been bred to be larger and more productive. As Harvest Public Media's Luke Runyon reports, that focus on genetics has some prominent livestock advocates ringing alarm bells.
Early this year, a Wisconsin dairy cow named Gigi made history. In 1 year, Gigi produced more milk than any other cow had before. Ever.
She's a diva.
That's Gigi's owner, Robert Banky, and she's a diva for a good reason. She produced nearly 75,000 pounds of milk. That's triple the national average.
She's very wide. You can literally fit your head and shoulders between her front legs right now.
Gigi is a Holstein, the iconic black and white dairy cow. Her stature gives her an edge. She clocks in at nearly a ton, and her shoulder rises to 5 feet 2 inches tall. Her ability to produce is coded into her genes.
Genetics is on our side as well. You can put anything in front of her and she will eat it.
We've bred them to produce a lot of milk, so what's behind that is that they have a big appetite.
Tom Lawler is a geneticist with the U.S. Holstein Association.
They definitely have gotten bigger, and they're definitely bigger than the beef cows.
What Gigi represents is a ceiling, what Holstein's bodies are capable of. At least for right now, thousands of new calves are born every day, most of the product of artificial insemination and other reproductive technologies meant to breed more productive, more efficient cows. Lawler says that's led to an American dairy herd that churns out more milk per cow than at any other time in history.
That's what we're doing. We're just sifting through the cattle, identifying the ones that are just a little bit more productive, a little bit more healthier, and trying to get more progeny from them and fewer from the other ones.
But that increase in milk production doesn't come without a few trade-offs. Colorado State University animal science professor Temple Grandin has been critical of the dairy industry. She says some farms are too focused on breeding hulking Holsteins with insatiable appetites and deep udders.
Instead of going for maximum milk production, let's optimize it.
Grandin says focusing on production can lead dairy farmers to breed cows more susceptible to lameness or infection, and it can cause a drop in reproduction rates. She says smaller cows tend to produce less milk, but they last longer and calve more often. It may not be as profitable right away, but it pays off, she says.
And if you just go for the big, gigantic Holsteins and only get 2 years of milking, that's not very sustainable.
Here comes the feed truck. Here comes breakfast.
If breeding ever larger cows has some drawbacks, one way to coax more milk out of the herd is to focus on cow comfort. Doug Ford is a veterinarian for a series of large dairies near Brush, Colorado. We're at a farm with nearly 2,000 cows in the state's northeastern corner. Today, he's doing a pregnancy check.
And if you just look at these cows, look how content they are. They're just enjoying the morning.
Ford's philosophy to increasing production on a farm comes down to handling. He teaches dairy staff low-stress techniques that allow the animals to move more freely between the milking parlor and their pens.
In the industry, we all have the same feed trucks, the same vaccines. What sets one
Yes.
operation apart from the other? It's the people, and it's you know, the way they treat the animals.
Ford says he understands that some consumers would readily call this operation a factory farm because of its size. But the realities of the market for milk have forced dairies to grow larger and become more efficient.
Milk prices haven't changed that much over the years. So what it amounts to is you have to produce more.
Producing more milk to make your cheese, yogurt, ice cream, and butter. But eventually, dairy farmers will hit the limits of what a cow's body is able to do. Luke Runyon, Harvest Public Media.
Up later, using the power and the heat of the earth to grow food in the cold months. Today we're checking in with a chef who made a big career move late last year. 9-time James Beard Award nominee David Talent announced he was leaving the kitchen at his eponymous restaurant in December. But he didn't leave the culinary world. He's now focusing his energy on a job at Indiana University. He tells us the story of stress and isolation in a professional kitchen and how he knew it was time for a change. It's quiet on a Monday morning at the Traditions Catering Kitchen. There's the rhythmic cracking of eggs over at the mixer, where Hayden Kemmerly is making snickerdoodles.
And then we'll let that mix for a little bit, and then we'll add the flour, cream of tartar, and salt. Let that mix and chill the dough for about 30 minutes, and dip them up, and they're ready to go.
Head chef David Talent is sitting at a high-top bar, clicking away at his laptop.
Starting to get the week planned, starting the ordering process.
He's been doing this sort of thing his entire professional life, but mostly as the head chef and owner of Restaurant Talent. Over those 12 years, he could simply send text messages to farmers to order his food. Now it's a bit more complicated. He has to work within the Indiana University system. He's also cooking more than just dinner.
This past weekend was busy. We had some student events, some larger student events that were, 150, 160 things. One was a dinner, one was a lunch, and we had breakfasts going on all those days. Those days as well. So we're like breakfast, lunch, dinner for 3 days, and then a couple of days where there's not. There's maybe one event. And to me, doing one event, even if it's for 100 people, is kind of slow.
Talent would like to make his weeks even busier than that. He's only been focusing on this catering gig for 1 month, so he's still trying to ramp up business. But then he pauses and breaks into a smile.
It's extremely less stressful, for sure.
To understand how he got here, we have to go back to July 2015. At that point, he'd already notched 9 straight nominations as a semifinalist for the Best Chef of the Great Lakes Region for the James Beard Awards. But what was next? What would his legacy in food actually be?
So many people have opened multiple restaurants and done multiple things, and, guys are on different continents and in different states. I was like, surely I can have 2 things going at the same time.
So he took on the job of head chef at Indiana University's catering. Summers can be slow for restaurants in college towns like Bloomington, Indiana. But once football season hits in October, things can get hectic, really hectic. It would be a full day working on the hotline at the restaurant, plus his duties planning and cooking big meals for IU events.
I was kind of like, well, for me, I felt like I was half-assed on both jobs. And I decided at that moment, I'm like, this isn't okay with me, Because I always felt, the whole time, I felt like when I was here, I was worrying about what was happening at the restaurant. When I was at the restaurant, I was thinking about all the things that I needed to get done here, and it was just, it was an uneasy feeling. I wasn't sleeping well.
He wasn't spending time with his family. He wasn't even living his life. That was his breaking point. It's not something they prepare you for in culinary school, he says. You don't talk about finding a work-life balance, and you definitely don't talk about emotions in the kitchen.
You joke about it, but you don't really talk about it. You don't sit down your cooks and, how are you feeling today? You just don't do it, It's like, are you hungover today?
And yet, 12 to 16-hour workdays do take their toll mentally and physically.
Most people don't really understand what it's like to do what we do, what it's like to run a restaurant and to have that pressure and to be out there every single day, every single dish. You're out there to be judged. And there's something that's fragile about what it is that we do. And who we are, and when you do it, and this is the way you choose to express yourself. It's kind of a high wire act, sometimes with a net and sometimes without.
These days, he's not up on that high wire every night, and he's serving a different kind of customer with the catering. He says he won't miss the competition of running a restaurant in a small town.
The dining public make it a little bit like the Roman. In the pit, and they just kind of the Colosseum, and they pit people. It almost kind of sometimes feels that way, like, and you know, to a certain extent, because I mean we're all competing for the same money, for the same dollars, for the, you know, and you know, I still, you know, my food cost has to be in line, my labor cost has to be in line, and you know, like I have to be generating a certain amount of business, so I'm still, you know, I'm still competing, but it's just a little bit, it's a little bit different. The weight doesn't fall squarely on my shoulders. That's kind of the part for me that's a lot less stressful.
He'll finish placing his orders in a couple hours. No catering events until later on in the week. Hayden, over at the mixer, will be finished with the snickerdoodles soon, and then the workday will be over.
I really, you know, it's really nice. I mean, I cook dinner almost every single night at home. You know, learning to cook for two as opposed to cooking for more is... there was a week or two where we had lots of leftovers in the fridge, and so I'm kind of learning to adjust that a little bit, or, you know, just inviting more people over for dinner.
David Talent is head chef at Traditions Catering. You can see a picture of him, not cooking food and not in a chef coat, just sitting with his laptop at eartheats.org. Coming up...
The better the chocolate you use, the better the quality of the beverage you're going to have. And since you're celebrating, go ahead and splurge and get some good chocolate.
That's Daniel Orr. He'll make two chocolate recipes for your at-home Valentine's Day. And we speak with a couple gardeners about how they've extended the growing season. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. It's a sweet day at Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
Valentine's Day is coming up, and so what we're going to do is something really simple that you can make at home, a quick little chocolate fondue. And it's very simple. You don't even really need a recipe for it. Have some boiling cream, and then you add your chocolate chips to it. Stir this until it all melts, and then if it's a little bit thin, you can always add more chocolate. And this makes what the business is called a ganache, which is just dark chocolate and heavy cream. And you see how that's getting a nice, rich color. Now I'm going to add some other flavorings. I'm going to add a little bit of orange zest and a pinch of my sweet seasoned spice blend, which is a combination of star anise and cloves and nutmeg and all kinds of goodness. I'm going to put just a little pinch of salt and a little pinch of pepper. And what that does is it will wake up your tongue and allow you to taste all the flavors even better. Okay, and so we have something that is very kind of rich and thick and will coat your berries. You could even make it a little bit spicy by putting a touch of cayenne in there, and that will liven things up for the night.
Or cinnamon would be great in this. Cinnamon is important to the flavor of our next sweet treat. It's a Caribbean hot chocolate.
You want to use a good quality chocolate. The better the chocolate you use, the better the quality of the beverage you're going to have. And since you're celebrating, go ahead and splurge and get some good chocolate. All right, we have this nicely chopped. We also have a couple of vanilla beans. And what we're going to do is we're just going to slice those lengthwise. Okay, and when we do that, we're exposing the little seeds inside the vanilla bean. And those are going to really perfume the warm dairy mixture that you have. Over here we have our milk, which I've already scalded. I'm just going to pour that into a nice hot pot. Okay, and then we're going to add our cream. Okay, and then our other flavorings are going to be
some cinnamon sticks. I've got 3 pieces of cinnamon stick. I've taken a vegetable peeler, and I've peeled 1/2 an orange, so we have these nice chunks of orange zest that we'll be able to strain out later. Our sweetener, we're going to use some brown sugar. Okay, I'm going to add the chocolate. Okay, and we're just going to stir that in. We just want all that chocolate to melt and incorporate into the dairy. And once that's done, we can turn off the fire. You want to take your whisk and really kind of agitate the liquid, and you're going to make it a little bit frothy. You're also going to make sure that all those little bits of chocolate are completely mixed in. All that we have left to do is to serve it. You have your nice warm mugs to ladle your hot chocolate into. And then depending on what you want, you could either put a float of some whipped cream on top, or you could put a marshmallow or even a homemade marshmallow. But what we're going to do is we're going to celebrate the Midwest with just a wee splash of bourbon. And so it makes it kind of an adult drink, something that you can celebrate with.
As the chef said, these are so easy, you don't even really need a recipe. But you know, I like to have recipes handy just in case. So we've compiled those in the latest post at eartheats.org. It's been a snowy start to 2016 for some parts of the country. When the ground is covered and frozen, it makes sense to put off thoughts of a lush green garden. But we've got a couple stories about growing food in the cold months. For Jamie Scholl, it's about preparing your garden in the fall to survive throughout the winter.
I'm one of these strange people. It's like when someone asks me, can you teach the putting the garden to bed class? I'm like, well, because I usually don't typically put my garden to bed. I utilize it all the time.
She teaches gardening through My Edible Eden. If she had a motto for her business, it would probably be something like this.
Planting doesn't just happen one time of year, and neither does harvest.
If you drive past Scholl's garden this time of year, you'll see snow, of course. Underneath, it's a layer of straw.
The straw will insulate. So a straw is hollow in the center, and that is like insulation. It provides a lot of, think of a straw bale house. That's an amazing amount of insulation there. So if you cover your root veggies with this, you'll easily keep the ground from freezing and then be able to harvest.
Carrots, for instance. She says they're even sweeter when you harvest them this time of year. If you're not so lucky to still have food in the ground, she suggests a building project. Construct raised beds and turn them into hoop houses. Then when it's time for tomatoes, for instance, the ground inside the hoop house will be warmer and more welcoming.
So in your raised bed, make it a larger raised bed, put your PVC pipes on it, cover it with plastic, and then you'll be able to get it warmer in there. Have your soil conditioned to where it's light and fluffy and aerates. You can put your tomatoes in early if you want earlier tomatoes. Make them cherry tomatoes. Those will ripen earlier.
You can see Jamie Scholl in action in her garden at eartheats.org. Lots of pictures of happy plants inside hoop houses. I just posted a video on Twitter showing you how to make your own hoop house. Find that at twitter.com/eartheats. Another story about extending the season from Harvest Public Media. You'll find plenty of fresh produce at the grocery store this time of year. Carrots from California, or peppers from Mexico. Thanks to a geothermal greenhouse, maybe Nebraskans could start buying local citrus. Grant Gerlach has more.
I'm at a local grocery co-op in Lincoln, Nebraska called Open Harvest. They sell a lot of locally grown fruits and vegetables here, at least during the spring and summer and fall they do. But it's the middle of winter now, and this is when the local food supply starts to freeze up.
We can get kale and some culinary herbs this time of year.
Nicole Seville is the produce manager at Open Harvest.
Otherwise, the only other local option is a soil mix in our garden center.
Which means the carrots and onions and pears and radishes on the shelf right now made a long trip to get here.
This time of year, we are sourcing globally, almost. It hurts me to say because, you know, the fossil fuels that it takes to get things here is astronomical. But we try to source from within the United States whenever we can. Florida and California are going to be the two biggest options.
So this time of year, you might be able to get kale from Nebraska. What about oranges?
No, I wish, though. I sure do wish.
Well, I recently met someone who would like to grant that wish.
We can grow the best citrus in the world right here on the High Plains.
This is Russ Finch. We're in his greenhouse near Alliance in western Nebraska. He calls it the greenhouse in the snow. Finch built and designed it himself. It's like a citrus grove inside, with lemons the size of oranges and oranges the size of grapefruits in Nebraska.
This is a Valencia orange that's the standard juice orange.
But the other unique thing about the greenhouse is it's geothermal. It harnesses the Earth's heat. All the heating and cooling comes from pumping air through underground tubes.
All we try to do is keep it above 28 degrees in the winter. And we have no backup system for heat. The only heat source is Earth's heat at 52 degrees at 8 foot deep.
The idea behind Finch's design is that you can grow a variety of crops year-round in a low-energy, low-carbon system. If that were to work on a large scale, Nebraska stores could sell local lettuce in the dead of winter, maybe even local oranges.
I think it's a fascinating idea.
Stacy Adams teaches horticulture and greenhouse management at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. He says there are different designs for low-energy greenhouses. Some move air or water underground. Some store solar heat in water tanks. He says a lot of people are testing sustainable ways to get through cold winter nights.
We could use fossil fuels, but if we can make the environment better by using the sustainable options, why not do it? It's basically free energy that we could capture.
Energy is one of the biggest costs for Midwestern greenhouses. Adams says geothermal greenhouses can work, but there are limitations to such a low-energy system. For instance, it's good for cold crops like kale, cabbage, lettuce.
But when we start getting into the warm-loving crops like tomatoes, which everybody loves, and cucumbers and squash, then we're talking about greenhouses that need to be much warmer.
It's actually easier to grow oranges in a cold greenhouse than tomatoes, Adams says. Also, low-energy greenhouses are most efficient when they're small, meaning they might supply a farmer's market, but probably not a supermarket. To grow more, you'll need more energy, perhaps fossil fuels. Don Thilmany studies local food at Colorado State University. She says growing in local greenhouses isn't always best for energy consumption.
It might actually, energy-wise, make more sense to ship from faraway distances because we do have a lot of energy-efficient ways to ship, including trains, barges, and such.
But ideas like greenhouse in the snow could change that equation.
In the case where people are being innovative, where some of that energy is an alternative form, it might make a lot of sense to produce locally year-round.
That could give winter a local flavor, even in the Midwest. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
See a video of Russ Finch inside his greenhouse at eartheats.org. Thanks to the crew, Aabon Binder, Chad Bouchard, Mark Chilla, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Betsy Shepard, and the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Cardinal Spirits, a distillery making handcrafted spirits from regional ingredients in Bloomington, Indiana. More at cardinalspirits.com. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Stay warm. Till next time, I'm Annie Corrigan.